Welcome to the Workflow Show. I'm Nick Gold of Chesapeake Systems, accompanied by my colleague Merrill Davis. This is
Howdy, how?
episode 111 of the Workflow Show, and we have a guest today, culture jammer, professional freelance geek, independent journalist, Patrick Rowenhouse, who we've known for quite a few years through various projects. Patrick is very active here in the Baltimore area tech culture scene, but also kind of on a more national basis. And Patrick, we have today because he was just at the CES show, Consumer Electronics Show, and we thought, wouldn't it be fun to get his take on all of the funky stuff that he saw out there, but also from the perspective of an independent multimedia video-oriented journalist. So, Patrick, welcome to the Workflow Show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
CES always gets a lot of news. I was definitely kind of bombarded with a lot of little snippets over the last, week and a half, 2 weeks, just about, what folks in the consumer electronics industries were announcing and talking about. But if you had to maybe shoot a few themes that seemed to kind of be the primary themes that ran throughout the show, what would you say those were in your opinion?
4K production and Ultra HD are this year's thing.
Bet you Blackmagic is feeling the burn on that one.
Not necessarily. They have some 4K devices coming in the pipeline right now. They just released one of their capture cards.
I'm still waiting for the 2.5K devices in their pipeline.
Oh, I see what you're talking. You're talking about
Yeah.
the camera.
Yeah.
Yeah, that thing's sad.
Yeah, but so a lot of 4K production and accessories.
Samsung and Sony were really big on the push. Sony had their CEO, Kazurai, who was originally the CEO of Sony Computer Entertainment, taking full stage, basically replacing the former CEO, Sir Howard Stringer. They were just going really big into 4K TVs, going into multimedia sharing, creating a platform for 4K videos. They're going to be having about 12 of their videos by March now being 4K downloadable services. They'll be one of the few 4K providers for a download service, which they'll provide through other TV networks as well.
This can only be a good thing, right? Because when you're showing 4K at a consumer electronics show, then that really shows that it'll probably be ushered in and bring the price down over the period of the next year or so,
Well, yeah, like they first showed some of the 4K screens about 3 years ago. They were like behind closed door showings. And then last year, Sharp showed one of the first like 67 inch 4K images that didn't actually have a 4K processor on it, though. It was only 1080p image that was then upscaled to 4K. But this year was like everyone was like saying, okay, we did 3D last year. This is now 4K and Ultra HD as they're branding
So
it.
let me throw something out here. And first of all, I'm going to take just a little step back for our listening audience. So, a lot of people in the video world are familiar with 4K, but in case you're not, 4K refers to a screen resolution that's essentially four times as many pixels as 1080p. So imagine four 1080p screens worth of pixel resolution kind of next to one another in a quadrant. That's the amount of pixel resolution you have in a 4K image. And 4K traditionally, through today, has not been something that has been available at a consumer level.
No.
And we'll talk more about kind of what is and what isn't actually available today. But it's been used in the world of cinema. Originally, 4K resolution was one of the higher end resolutions, the next level beyond 2K. That actual film, shot on film cameras was scanned at to create a digital intermediary. And often those digital intermediaries would be what post-production was applied to. Sometimes just a rough cut. Maybe the final processing was actually done and conformed back to the original film over the last few years. If something is still shot in film and then scanned at, say, 4K, often it will then stay digital for the rest of production and post-production and even delivery now. Although nowadays, obviously, a lot of even cameras are originating content, maybe at 4K resolution, but digitally from the get-go. So it's a complete digital file-based workflow in production, post-production, and now delivery to cinema. And so, I'm going to throw like a little snide comment in here, Patrick and Meryl, and I'm curious to get your guys' opinions. You know, you were just saying, you know, last year and maybe even the year before, I know it was a big deal at NAB a couple of years ago, everyone was talking about 3D or stereoscopic. And now everyone's talking about 4K. And from what I gather, 4K resolution isn't even discernible by the human eye unless you have like a mega huge, like 80-inch plus television set and you're sitting close enough to it that you can even discern those pixels. So is this just another thing that, you know, the electronics industry is bandying about because they're like, oh crap, everyone invested in HD and they're not buying as many televisions and we couldn't get them excited about 3D really that much. Now we have to come out with something else to try to like reinvigorate sales, and maybe it's something that people don't really want or need. Well, your thoughts?
I wouldn't really say that. I mean, the first generation of 4Ks that people might know are the 4K Sony projectors that were available in theaters starting about 5 years ago. Here in the Baltimore area, one of the first 4K cinemas was the Landmark Theater right down in the Harbor East area. I had the pleasure of going to their opening because they had Blade Runner Final Cut in 4K, and it was actually the closest place to go see it within about a 5-state surrounding area.
How did I miss that?
I know.
Oh, man.
But 4K is, you know, when it comes down to it, it's not 4,000 lines of resolution. It's 3840 by 2160 for the Sony brand 4K. The other 4K cameras that people have probably heard of are like the Red Cinema 1 camera, which are now been updated to the Red Scarlet and Epics. And the workflow for producing those, you don't have to work with the same kind of large file like you did with MPEG-2 or P2P cards. You're actually dealing with a reference file. So it's recording an MP4 H.264 reference file to reference the larger format, raw format that you're recording in. Sony released their F65 camera. They announced it about a month ago, and they had it on display at CES and showing it off. And they also showed off the new recorder device that was for the originally released F700 camera series that was basically a really cheap entry-level Micro Four Thirds camera that was recording in 1080p with uncompressed HDMI out and a jog wheel for recording. But it was actually a really good camera. And they said this will be upgradable with a hard, an attachment to record into 4K. And they released that, and that upgrade's $6,000. So for entry-level cameras, that Sony camera, the FS700, was basically only $8,000 camera, and this new add-on attachment, $6,000. The new P65 cameras are going for just shy of $20,000. And then you also have Alexa, who's releasing their 4K camera. And so the actual workflow and cost of it is actually becoming relatively cheap and actually doesn't require a huge amount of intensive power because you're using these reference files to do the editing.
But do consumers care? I mean, who's going to trade in their high-def TV and decide, oh no, high-def isn't enough for me anymore? Because I always see it as consumers need to demand something before producers will have an inclination to invest in it. It's I notice very few producers leading the charge before they're being asked for something. And it's hard to imagine the video consuming public, except maybe outside of the world of cinema production, but for more generalized video production, really demanding 4K. I think a lot of people are still kind of getting used to HD being the default.
HD's been around for like, you know, close to 12 years now. I mean, like the peak TV at its time was like the Pioneer Curos, which were, you know, when they first came out back in like 97, they were upwards of $27,000. And before they discontinued the Pioneer Curo lines, they were still going for $12,000 for plasma television sets. And they were considered the pinnacle of black levels. But when you actually look at these TVs, when they had them on display, they had ones as small as 50 inches. So yes, you do need a larger format TV to represent that higher resolution, because in 1080p, you can have as small as a 32-inch screen and represent that 1080p image from about 5 feet away. With the new 4K TVs, you have to have a 50-inch TV from about 8 feet away. And the one thing about these new TVs is a lot of them are really brand new backlit colors where they're no longer doing edge lit. They're doing Samsung actually had some really nice ones, as well as Sony, where they're aerial lit. So there's like LEDs along the back edge, and so you can change the depth of them. And then they have the OLED 4K TVs, which when black is black, that's because they've turned off those pixels. So the image quality is like nothing you've really ever seen before. I mean, when you look at the video that they have on here, they're using this RAW format that Sony just made for their new 4K stuff when they were demoing it for them. And it's hard to really say, but it looks like if you've ever seen a high-quality glossy print for photos, it's that sharp and in moving images. They had some demo videos of a girl running around and showing the contrast ratio. The color contrast ratio is amazing. I mean, it's a gambit of colors that are in static that of a printed image because of the resolution.
So you're saying this round of 4K televisions and projection technologies, the pixel count is one element of their impressiveness, yeah. But the manufacturers are kind of baking additional types of newer presentation technologies into these screens. So across many levels, pixel count just being one of them, they are just superior television screens.
Well, it's not just that, but
video viewing devices.
Well, it's not just that, but the actual color gambit for 4K is basically about, I believe, four times of what the current 1080p color range is for representing the colors. ProRes 444 format is the Apple 4K video codec format. And if you look at the color specs that it can handle, it's impressive, to say the least. The ability of being able to do these editing, you know, in these formats and looking at the kind of quality image you get, while we might not be able to look at it with a 1080p image, it's going to show across when it comes down to color richness and color depth. And the fact is that with the update for the home consumer market to the H.265 format, which will offer the ability of using the current megabit per second streams, you'll be getting 4K videos at the same streaming quality that you have to have for a Netflix video for 1080p. And
you've kind of headed off my next question, which is, okay, it's all well and good that the camera and production equipment and post-production equipment manufacturers have high quality ways of representing this much, you know, media data. But with the next generation video encoding codec that presumably the industry will embrace, H.265, the follow-up to 264.
A very clever
consumers
clever
are actually going to be able to see some of this quality because of just that advancement in the compression technologies for, you know, that Comcast and other video providers will use to get these videos to you.
Yeah, the one current overhead issue with H.265 is that it is really processor intensive. I don't know if you remember when H.264 first came out, before they had onboard video card processing for like NVIDIA and ATI, but this is a lot more workhorse intensive. So you're going to have a multi-core processor in any set-top box or console that people probably watch videos through to be able to process that new format. But you will be able to get those 4K resolutions at current 5 megabit and even as much as 10 megabit per second bit rates.
So are basically nothing but the latest generation of computers probably is going to be able to play this format back. It probably isn't a terribly relevant format for mobile devices anyway.
Oh, no.
So that the fact that they don't have additional processing power is probably irrelevant because there's no need to have 4K resolution video on an iPad. And, you know, give it a couple of years and Intel and NVIDIA and these folks will, you know, have H.265 hardware codecs built into their systems. You know, by that point, it won't be as much of a burden to actually play that next generation video format back. Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. Similar progression to H.264, and I guess that means it, you know, I would say, if we're just starting to even figure out how this stuff could be done, it's probably, I would think, going to be the end of the decade before it's even close to kind of even approaching ubiquitousness. Meryl, what do you think about all this stuff? I'm curious to get your take. You obviously have an appreciation for quality, you know, coming from production and post-production, but, I mean, what do you think this is going to be picked up by consumers at all?
Well, I think it was a good pointed question initially as to whether or not this is really something that is going to appeal to the consumer. Patrick was right on the money. This workflow is totally born out of production and post-production. And to that end, there's always application for that. So, he talked about those 4K projectors. There is always a compelling reason, if you consider yourself a consummate filmmaker, to generate your source files at a higher resolution with the anticipation that at some point you are going to have a premiere between four walls at a theater, which means that if you are aware of the existing technology, you can have your theater goers actually see the closest thing to the best theater experience that they can have. Now, that's not going to translate, not today, to the home market, I don't think, only because of time and all the wonderful things that the two of you already talked about. I don't know that it will take till the end of the decade to see this level of adoption. I think, we're going to see a far more compressed time frame. Every time we do this go-round, I like always to look at the video game market as sort of a good example of a sort of a compressed time frame every cycle. If you look at the time frame between every single video game system over the last four generations, I anticipate that, we'll be at a two and a half year cycle at some point. But everybody who is worth their salt as a production fellow might already know what a red camera is, right? So there's always that recognition and there's always that conversation to be had. In fact, I was shooting a documentary and it was largely a DSLR shoot. I had the gear rented for an extra day or two, and I told a buddy, I was like, I can hook you up with it. I got some 5D Mark IIs and whatever. If you need the gear for a day or two to do some production, let me know. He said, I don't want that. I'm going to get a Red. So there is a level of expectation. Certainly, if you are a budding cinematographer, there is a need and a want to get that. So there's limitations of hardware at this point, but I think that the public is becoming more savvy. I think there is a place where most people are not even the HD content that they're consuming now is not on a Blu-ray. It's usually either through an over-the-top application like Netflix or Hulu, or they're downloading it. So with no specific limitation on a format as it relates to 4K, I think you could see a wider adoption of that.
Well, okay, let's just field this one for a while and say
4K it's going to happen. It's not going to happen yet.
It's clearly becoming more prevalent on the production side. The technologies are just getting out there. It's cheaper to shoot 4K. We're starting to have good, slightly less expensive screens. Because, Patrick, how much if I wanted to buy a 4K television now, how much is it going to cost me?
The depending on which model you get, Samsung was giving the estimates that their 4K OLED TVs would probably be about $26,000, and then their LED 4K television sets would probably be in the $16,000 range. But
nobody's going to buy these things.
And Patrick, I'm curious, from CES time, mm-hmm. when they give, because they never give like steadfast pricing, right? They give the general sense of what it will be when it comes to market. In your experience, since you've been there multiple times, do you see that price waver go up or down when the product actually does hit the market?
Older times of CES, before I went there, you follow the markets and the trends and stuff like that, and yeah, you would see a lot of wavering, but because of the fact that everyone's pushing for this technology at the same time, and the fact that we've gotten to this kind of ultra-fast turnaround time, you have to look at television sets and all this technology in the same way you look at Moore's Law when it comes down to CPUs. The first one's always going to be like a multi-million dollar processor. Like that first Intel Pentium 7 is going to be like $250 million. But once you get the fabrication process where you're producing them at a steady, fast return, you're going to have a much cheaper device. It's kind of like how the iPhones, once you get more and more into the, the production cycle, you can drop down the price. And I think that in the next 3 years, you're going to see a $5,000 60-inch 4K television set with smart features. And one other feature that, like, say, for example, Samsung is doing, they're trying to get it so that the TVs last longer, but you can upgrade the hardware inside of it. Like, for example, last year they announced this new silicon chip system where you can basically throw in extra processors into your
Skynet.
Skynet. The Google Epic video from a couple years back reminds me of that. But I think what's really interesting is that a lot of videographers and directors who said, I'll never record in digital, like, you know, Quentin Tarantino and M. Night Shyamalan and all those types, are kind of being forced to go to 4K. And then they realize that 4K and then the 8K and 16K, which are also being used right now in development, actually the 4K that they have now from Alexa and from Sony can get on par with the Panascan vision of Lawrence of Arabia. They were showing the transfer they're doing from Columbia TriStar MGM from Sony when they were at CES, and Lawrence of Arabia was amazing for the 4K transfer. I think what's going to be really interesting is because of this high resolution, you're getting the equivalent of, depending on which camera you're using, you're going to be getting the equivalent of possibly a 75 millimeter print.
So let me ask you this. If I get one of these 4K screens at $20,000+ in the next few months when they become available, is there any actual way other than playing 4K content directly off of professional grade production and post-production equipment to say, just watch a movie in 4K?
Yeah.
It 4K seems projector. Like the camera manufacturers and the display manufacturers, who obviously are sometimes the same entities, are leading ahead here. But there's not really a whole lot in the way of consumer-oriented delivery technologies.
Well, actually, that's the thing. Sony's,
someone can actually play this stuff.
Sony's developing an over-the-top platform to provide downloadable content that will be stored on hard drives, so you'll be able to download a 4K movie or watch it streaming. They'll be having that ready by summertime when they start actually releasing these 4K television sets for the higher-end market who will be able to purchase them. But the fact is that you're going to have this content. There's already an archive of movies that have been recorded in the last 5 years that have been recorded on RED cameras. And now you have these, you know, for example, as I said, the FS700 from Sony's been out for about 2 years. And now that's going to be able to record in 4K with the attachment. So you're going to start seeing more 4K cameras. And they actually were showing off a successor to the X1 from Sony that was an easy to carry point, like not point shoot, but, you know,
over the shoulder.
Not over the shoulder. It's okay. It's a side. It's like the X1, which is the side one, like a small one, like about like a. Actually, it would be more equivalent to like the 700 UK, I think, was the model. Maybe
we have computers. We can look.
Yes, thank you. It's the one that they would like sell in the Sony Style Store and stuff like that, and have on display. But you didn't have the replaceable lenses. But they were showing off the prototype of that one, and they're going to be selling that for about 9,000. They said, and so that's the estimated price now. So if you look at that in a year. Like, for example, I have the Panasonic AGAF100.
Good
and
camera.
Yeah, I know. When that started selling about 2 years ago, it was $16,000. I got mine for refurbished for $2,500.
Okay, so the stuff is going to get cheaper.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I remain a little skeptical. You know, the consumer electronics manufacturers and the camera folks and the production equipment folks were very excited about stereo a few years ago. I think we can kind of agree that consumers have not...
We haven't adopted
it super heavily, but
yeah, I totally agree.
It's out there now, and 4K is emerging.
3D is bunk,
and maybe erupting outside of the world of cinema. You know, let's table this. We'll obviously keep on top of it. I'm curious, what other themes ran through the show as you were there? I mean, Consumer Electronics Show runs the gamut between, you know, the major television manufacturers, the Sonys and Panasonics and what have yous, all the way down to like Kickstarter projects, literally. I'm curious if maybe at the other end of the spectrum, more of the bootstrapped startup kind of weird little tech ventures that are sometimes represented in the hallways at CES, did you pick up on any other kind of interesting currents that seem to maybe tell a story about, you know, where just consumer electronics industry is going?
There's a large push for DIY projects. The MakerBot guys had their booth, and before they were back in the South Hall, like really far back. But now this year, they're actually more into the front of the South Hall. The South Hall is considered the there be dragons. If you go far enough back, you know, in this hall, it's like there'll be everything from like people will have stands of like posters that have lights blinking behind them. That's how cheesy some of the stuff is in the back of the South Hall. But South Hall this year was a little bit more about a lot of DIY projects.
Can you, and the MakerBot, that's like a 3D printer,
yeah,
right?
The MakerBot's a 3D printer, and there were a lot of consumer-branded 3D printers now. There's about total of like 20 different ones that were on display in the South Hall.
That's amazing that yeah. you can literally print things now. I recall playing a video game, Resident Evil Code Veronica X, and there was a 3D printer in it, and I was totally excited by that. But also at the time, it was really sort of like, you know, something you could have in a video game and not in real life. Here now, you can make things. Can you make keys? You can make housings. What were the things they're showing?
Some of the things you can make with them are actually fully moving parts. Depending on the quality grade of 3D printer you have, you can actually build metal parts. There's a company in the UK called Make Bikes that actually makes their bikes out of a titanium powder resin that when they print out and then they throw it into a kiln for a couple hours, it's a fully working titanium joint that could only be produced by printing it because it has a honeycombed inside to it when they put the bike mounts in there for extra strength. And
that's wild.
Some of the things, there's a project that someone released where they could actually print out a gun.
I was just going to ask that because that, you know, I think of the Terminator. He's like, so why don't you just turn into a bomb and, you know, get him? He says, well, I can't because, you know, that
complex required chemical parts that come together.
And moving parts. Yes. Yeah. So that's constantly what I'm hearing.
Well, the moving parts are possible because you're basically, depending on the quality of printer, there's a company called Z Printer, for example, that allows you to use four different types of quote unquote materials. And one of them is a water soluble material. So once you've printed it out, you have to make sure you have a lattice work to maintain structural ability if you have arcs and stuff like that, because you're printing it layer by layer. So there's about four different ways of doing 3D printing. One of them is the submersion, where you're actually using a laser to cause a latex or liquid film to harden as you're passing it through. You can also use an ultraviolet laser to do that. There is the sand dust method, where you're using sand to hold the stuff solid as you're going layer by layer and printing it out. And so you just add more sand to it relatively over time. There also is the acrylics-based printer systems, which are what MakerBot and stuff like that do. Is they use ABS plastic that's run through like a normal printhead. That all started out of a program called the RepRap, which is an open-source 3D printer platform, and that just kind of gave birth to all these other 3D printers.
Wow, there's an open-source 3D printer platform.
Yeah, there's
an open source 3D printer sitting on the shelf behind you. It's just in a cardboard box because I haven't assembled it yet.
Oh, yeah, I remember a year ago when that showed up at the office.
Yeah, but I mean, you're actually seeing now these legitimate 3D printers that can print things that are movable parts and movable things. There's actually here in the Maryland area, at the Community College of Baltimore in Catonsville, they actually have a fabrication lab that's open to the public. You have to take a $200 class to teach you how to use the equipment, but they have a laser cutter, a 3D printer, a bunch of other tools. And there's also at the Digital Harbor Tech Community Center, they now have access to train kids on how to do 3D CAD programs, and they have a MakerBot and a few other laser printers and laminate printers in there as well. So this is becoming commonplace, and I think what's going to be really interesting is that in the Baltimore area particularly, there's a big push for revisiting manufacturing and kind of this return to boutique shop creation, because back in like when America first started, we were 97% of America were self-owned businesses, like small businesses that were owned by people. And now it's like 90% of people now work for corporations. Well, I think you're going to have a large swing back because you're going to have locally, I need to have this printed, or as MakerBot and all these other organizations call, they call them shapeables. And the Pirate Bay, which is the most, you know, famous torrent website, has a section now that they call printables. So I can download the CAD file and print out anything I want, from toys to equipment.
You
and
know,
stuff.
I'm imagining a time during the zombie apocalypse where this would be appropriate to have accessibility to, like, immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of the things that you can do is, like, for example, I designed a for shapeables, a hood, so you can actually put this be printed out, and then it has a bunch of slots that you can do, but it's you can slide in a piece of two-way glass and then put your iPad there, but it's a hood for doing
waterboarding
teleprompter.
Oh, got it.
A teleprompter that'll fit onto your camera, and that way you still have access to using your follow focus control wheels, but it's a 3D printed, you know, thing, and you could throw it to any 3D printer and print it out.
That's so I've heard the 3D printing equipment industry often is kind of likened these days to the early hobbyist days of the PC industry, when you used to go to the big computer club shows in the even early 80s, heck, late 70s, and there was a lot of interesting activity, and it wasn't maybe quite ready for prime time, but it just seems like one of those things that could just get really big, and it's not necessarily tough to imagine a few years out where you have this thing that kind of looks like a microwave oven sitting in your kitchen or something, and it's like, I need another fork. We didn't realize Uncle Nick was coming over for dinner, and you like print out a fork, you know?
Well, I think what's interesting is that the ideas of 3D printers, I remember them talking about this idea as a concept in everyone's house back on the old PBS TV series Newton's Apple back in like the early 90s. They've always had 3D printers. 3D printers have been around in the fabrication process. There's also been multi-access CNC machines that allow you to, you know, pivot, twist, and all that stuff. But you're having this fabrication process, which I think is a spurnout because I do agree it's the PC revolution, but it's not like how back in the days that, you know, HP was like, who the hell wants to own a personal computer? You're actually having people who've been wanting this for a long, long time. And the ability of saying, you know what, I broke something. Oh, well, you know what, the company won't give me a new replacement part. I can print it out myself. And I think there's a strong influence of people who want to have self-independence and be less dependent on a commercialization of products and gimmicks and gadgets and gizmos and whatnot.
One imagines that this is going to have an interesting effect on intellectual property law, given that, you know, intellectual property certainly has kind of included physical goods to a degree. I mean, we obviously have patents for actual physical items, but in a sense, if you consider the 3D CAD file for an object to be kind of a piece of media, a digital file, there's going to be this interesting blend of like media-oriented intellectual property as it relates to the physical production of objects. And let's say you buy a consumer object. I'm looking at a Nikon camera on my desk, and you know, let's say one of the little buttons or something fell off. Imagine someone had kind of scanned in all of the components of this very camera, and I go online to this sharing website, and I download the CAD plan for the particular button on this camera and then print it out in my 3D printer so I can pop it back into place. You know, I imagine that Nikon is not going to be thrilled about that, and that this is just going to open up this very bizarre world of intellectual property law where it's like, no, you don't even have the rights as a consumer to have like a plan for that part and a file that tells you how to make one yourself.
Well, the one thing that's interesting is that you bring that up is that the one thing that's really important about this whole 3D printing revolution that's happening right now is a lot of it is spurned out of the open source community. A lot of it is about people who want to be able to provide stuff to people. I mean, the joke was, you wouldn't download a car, would you? It was like a joke off the IT crowd about piracy and whatnot. But
that was actually a real piracy ad.
That was?
Yeah.
I thought that was a joke from the IT crowd.
No, that was an IT crowd spoof of the actual
issue. Yeah, I saw the original ad, but they didn't say you wouldn't download a car, would you?
They totally did.
They did?
They did.
I thought that wasn't in the original
one. No, that's totally in the original one. It's like when they get to like, you wouldn't beat your grandmother, that's like when it's the faux stuff. But that was like a real ad.
Like, you wouldn't kill a police officer and then shit in his hat.
No. No, well, yeah, no, that was real legit.
But, okay. But, for example, so you wouldn't download a car. Well, the joke was, yeah, we can now. They've actually been a couple 3D printed cars. But talking about that, there was a company. Let's see, 1 second. Let me pull up their name real quick. It's called Miravoid. The guy who was originally a CTO for Microsoft filed for a patent that allows him to put DRM on 3D printed CAD files. And like, this was basically saying, yeah, right, that's not going to happen because you already have this entire platform and idea of the physibles and these files being shared. And a lot of these can also be created in like Google Shapeup. So you could actually take Google Shapeup files and print Shapeout? Yeah. But you can take those files and print them out very easily.
Not only that, but like if you're going to read like the law to the letter and say, well, you know, for example, if you treat it as source code, well then, you know, what's to stop somebody from simply getting the general sense of what the design is and then designing something that is functionally the same but maybe doesn't have one extra curve or a line here? Then it gets even murkier, you know. They can...
Well, and I'm going to throw another angle out there. I mean, because, you know, listen, everyone who's 35 like myself has probably ripped a CD from a friend at some
jail
point
time
in college
now.
Life, but
piracy.
You know, I go out of my way to purchase
you
music
wouldn't rip a CD
almost predominantly through iTunes, right?
Yeah.
And so let's, you know, but we know that the music industry and now the video industry have been largely affected by piracy, although I guess that's arguable. But let's presume for a moment that there's some negative financial impact to them when
yeah,
someone
it's on them paying
shares
their lawyers
something
to scare
for
people.
Free that
$16
maybe
that
other
said,
people would
billion.
Have paid money for. Well, how's this going to play out with physical objects? You were talking, Patrick, about like small community businesses where people are actually putting the hands of production back in their own shops, and someone has, you know, let's say I'm here in Brooklyn, right? Everyone has like their own like craft
their artisan
soap shop
beer
or, you know, artisanal light bulb, you know, fixtures or, you know, something.
Artisanal
that's just
knives
what Brooklyn
company.
Is all about these days.
They chip their
so
ice
let's
with
say
an ice pick.
Someone in Brooklyn 10 years from now has their little shop and they've come out with like some cool little widget that they can print out using 3D printers that they have on the premises, right? What's to stop someone from just pirating the CAD diagram and printing it themselves?
Well, the like, point is that they would have
the
to
first...
The only
people who will be making money are the people who sell the raw materials that you put into your 3D printer.
Well, yeah, the big thing is that you have to put the CAD file on the internet first. You know, it puts the lotion on the skin or it gets the hose. So it's like... Yeah, I know that was random, but I like using that phrase. it's like meow. Meow. So what here now, meow? But you have to put that file on the internet first. So if they haven't put the file on the internet and they just basically say all the CAD files are on a box that are not connected to the internet, no one else will have access to it except for them. And
but
so,
the thing is, right, it's pretty – they also have laser scanners, three-dimensional laser scanners. And so if you buy a widget and you break it apart literally, physically into its constituent pieces – you can scan it and theoretically make your own CAD diagram for it or even slightly tweak it. Maybe you even improve it, right?
Well,
but
nothing
is really stopping you from necessarily reverse engineering some funky thing that someone
but that's
came
perfectly
up with
legal,
so you can now produce it yourself.
By the U.S. By the U.S. Patent Office.
It's an interesting reality that we're starting to see unfold here. I don't think there's any true answers at this point because it's not prevalent enough, but... I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if anyone can kind of
make
money in that environment off of those types of things that they might be producing.
The U.S. Patent Office was supposed to protect small businesses and small individuals.
I mean, that was its origination.
Yeah, it was
when you talk about, like, you know, what is copyright law, it was supposed to, at its essence, push things forward, you know, stimulate
the individual.
Yeah, and the growth, but you know, it's some sort of weird perverse upside down thing.
What happened is that you had basically the formation of the U.S. Patent Office. You had the ability of having individuals be protected for creating a product for a certain limited time, saying, okay, you've put all this effort into creating this product. You got 15 years. If you don't create anything new in 15 years, screw you. The patent's open to the public. But with the push by legalization by large corporate entities that are multinational corporations, they've kind of kicked the can. So now you can have a patent be owned by a corporation and live as long as the life of the corporation. And then you have these patent trolls who buy up companies and get their patent portfolios. Famously, it's one of the guys who was one of the co-founders of Microsoft who basically got a lot of money, and he did that $4,000 micro-gastronomy book where they cut open microwave ovens and cut open pots to show you how things were cooking. He's a famous patent troll. You go down to Texas and there's this county in there that basically everyone goes to because they're very pro corporations and focusing on them for patents, but this idea of patents and stuff like that, I'm not going to go into that political hoola, but it is kind of a
I think we can agree that copyright law, trademark law, maybe patent law, there's definitely examples of abuse and those systems going outside of kind of their original envisionings. I would also submit that there's probably countless examples every day that are kind of more boring and you don't read about on the internet where people are legitimately using copyright law and patent law to protect the very things that those systems are supposed to protect. So it'll be an interesting story to see how this unfolds. So let's move on. We've talked about these 4K television systems and production systems. We talked about 3D printers and this very do-it-yourself ethic at CES. you know, maybe one more big theme, or maybe even a particular item that you saw, just maybe something oddball, but carried maybe a certain weight with you as someone who's generally pretty well aware of trends in technology, and, you know, something that maybe surprised you or stood out?
The big thing with CES is that this is a year that was really interesting. There was a lot of people saying this might be the last year that CES is relevant, because they're kind of
don't
having...
Don't they say that every year, though?
This was... There was an era about it that was a lot different. Usually people will be at the Venetian, or they'll be at it's called the LVH. It was originally the Hilton that's connected to the convention center. Like, they'll have side rooms and suites there to, you know, show people off their stuff, because even in the South Hall, for a 10 by 10 foot space to get for CES, it's like $10,000.
Did CES go E3? Is that what happened?
Yes, that's exactly what happened this year, is that they're going E3 1997.
So no more booth babes is what you're saying.
Well, there were booth babes, you know, this year, but the booth babes usually, the more, I do not mean
don't
to be,
don't digress here. I'm
no, no,
stop
no,
you.
This is not digressing. I actually find booth babes to be highly offensive. I'm one of those guys who doesn't like sports. I don't like strip clubs.
We'll get along just fine.
But
you want to play some Call of Duty or something later? Or I don't know.
Natural Selection, a really good game that's released on Steam, but you have to play it on the Windows because they don't have a Mac version.
Wah, wah.
Yeah, yeah. But the one thing with booth babes is that it's derogatory towards women, and the crappier your product is, the more likely you're going to have the skankier.
Right. The worse the product, the further down the neckline.
Yeah.
That's true. But, you know, so just to give a little bit of background, so what happened to E3 was it was largely a trade show, which CES is. Yeah. And as it grew and grew and grew, and there were, you know, why we're talking about booth babes is this was like a real big thing for the video game folks, was booth babes, booth babes. But at some point, they hit a tipping point, and they had to reevaluate what exactly this, you know, event was. It had become more, even though it says consumer in the title, this is still a trade show at its core.
The big people that come here are press, buyers who are coming in from, like, this is the International Consumer Electronics Show. I mean, there's IFA, which is in Berlin, mm-hmm. and then there's also, like, Computex, which is over in Taiwan, but that's typically more like computer parts and computer steps. There's also CTIA, which is about mobile phones, Cydia, which is about home theater equipment and also audio equipment. But CES is kind of like, this is the show pony. This is, like, you know, the Budweiser, you know, Clydesdales of gadget events. And you'll have people coming in from Europe and from Asia coming in to buy stuff. You know, they want to be able to see what's something we can throw in our stores to buy, like, you know, J&R, what's that other?
H&H?
I guess, thank you. B&H. B&H.
Oh, like, what are you? H&H?
And then, like, Best Buy, you know. Circuit City.
Their service was state of the art until they went out of business.
Exactly. I was at a table with, like, people who are, like, VPs of, you know, acquisitions for Best Buy, H.H. Gregg.
This is not the place to go if you, you know, it's like, you know, when they do international toy fairs, they're toy manufacturers. You wouldn't necessarily bring a child to that. In the same way, if you really, really like TVs, but this is not necessarily.
2 years ago, they actually was interesting. They partnered up with Gadget, with Pia Rojas from Gadget. He was one of the original founders of Engadget, mm-hmm. and also one of the original founders of Gizmodo. And they were partnering up with him, and you can actually come now. They have an open public pass now. So you no longer have to pay the $600 ticket.
They do?
Yeah, they have a 1-day, 2-day pass for quote-unquote fans of technology. And you sign up on their website, and it's a free pass.
I feel like that's, you know,
cheapening of the CES brand?
Yeah, I do. I feel as though if this is the case, then as soon as you get the fan into the mix, it always messes things up.
Well, what's interesting is that America is one of the only countries that doesn't have an open-to-the-public trade shows for these things. IFA is open to the public. For video games, Tokyo Game Show is probably one of the most famous video game expos that actually has the first 3 days are completely business only. The last 2 days are like cosplayers out the yin yang.
That is so Japanese.
But they also, in, was it Gamescom, which is in Berlin, mm-hmm. for video games, that's open to the public for the last 2 days. And then because of the fact that E3 has never been open to the public, which is always, you know, at the Los Angeles Convention Center, they, PAX, which is the Penny Arcade Expo, is now opened up, and is actually video game developers want to go to that instead of going to E3 because they want to get the fans' point of view about their games. I mean, what's a better way of testing your game but having diehard video game fans actually playing it and telling you, this sucks, fix it. And so there's an interesting dynamic of what is now open and what's now closed and what they should allow access to. But as we're saying, you know, CES is going the E3 route. Back in 97, they went from being at the Los Angeles Convention Center on Figueroa to basically saying, okay, everyone's going to have private hotel suites and you got to go to their hotels. And so trying to get around the city was a cluster.
So it's interesting. I think this external stuff may be impacting the overall quality of the product that's shown.
What's interesting is that the North Hall is where they typically have car audio as well as automobile manufacturers. Like, I go there and talk to Ford about their new electric cars that they have. But that used to be the quote-unquote iLounge area where they had a lot of the iProducts. And they would be like the most janky-looking rhinestone iPod cases. But this year, they really changed it up. The Chinese companies have kind of realized that having that strip mall kind of approach to a booth that looks like it's like in the no man's land of Canal Street in New York City of like Asian shops that sell really janky Chinese knockoffs is not the way you want to do it. And they actually really spiced up their booze for like what they're showing off. And I think that's a product of the fact that you have China becoming mature in the manufacturing process. I mean, a lot of China's stuff in the last 5 years before that was very gray market produced stuff where it's basically, you've probably seen this on 60 Minutes where like there'll be a company that's producing like golf clubs and they're making the titanium golf clubs. And then on the gray hours, which is the after hours, they're making those same golf clubs out of steel instead. And so like there's a lot of stuff that's copied off of, like famously a lot of technology companies, one that I'm not going to name, will produce knockoff
systems. What's it rhyme with?
Okay, I? they famously, you know, copied off of Cisco routers, even to the point where they just basically copied off the Cisco iOS for network information systems.
That's true.
And the entire African continent is powered by their routers, and the majority of the Middle East as well. And they're not bad routers, but there's some interesting security issues that the U.S. had a reason to block a certain company for America, and I'm not going to say why, but it's previous job-related thing.
Sure, and you could just do a quick Google search and learn more about that.
Yeah.
So, guys, I want to wrap this up, but I would like Patrick to maybe respond to that last question I asked about, you know, just any other interesting gizmos you came across this year, anything surprising, little tiny things that maybe hold a little promise for the future.
I think one thing that's interesting is the move over to over-the-top platforms. Roku announced a partnership just 2 weeks before CES that was Time Warner Cable is going to be providing all of their HD channels to watch over Roku.
Is that with an existing subscription service?
That's with the existing subscription, but the fact is that means that's killing the cable box. And there's talks of them also providing online DVR support.
Well, I mean, that's a pretty wise, you know.
Well, I think that the reason why they announced that is because you don't understand how much this scares people, but Google Fiber in Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas City, Kansas.
The only reason I've ever considered even going anywhere near Kansas City.
I know. Is scaring the ever-loving pants off of all the entire telecom industry. And, like, for example, AT&T and Verizon are trying to get them blocked and saying it's illegal for them to do this.
Yeah, they have a very, very heavy lobbyist contingent that, even to get city ordinances passed to prevent something that seems so intuitive and
like
useful.
I had a chance to use it. 900 megabit per second internet speeds, and that's them still working on fixing it.
You know what I get? I get 3.5 megs down in my Comcast.
And also, what's interesting is they have these boxes, all their HD boxes, saved to the Google Drive index. So you get 1 terabyte of space on Google Drive, so you can watch any videos you record anywhere you want if you have internet access. Each of these boxes also acts as Google TV interfaces that will search Netflix, Amazon, TV being broadcasted, will record to them. each one of them acts as a Wi-Fi repeater for your house, and they all have gigabit connections.
Why would you need a set-top box at this place? And I think Time Warner is actually very smart to go this way, because everyone's already got the equipment in place, and really, if you're...
There's a copyright issue with doing online DVR support. Recording it at your house and then uploading to a storage facility that's still encrypted in the chain is different, but having someone record it at a facility outside of your house is... No, that's copyright infringement. And there's a huge hurdle with the fact that the way the patent office and the copyright office in America works, because it's no longer about protecting the individual. It's about protecting old money and old paradigms.
And the corporate entity, which is now a person. But what's
it's always been a person since the legalization of since the 14th Amendment. They actually threw that in there when they emancipated the slaves, and so corporations got their person status when we freed African-American slaves. So
I missed that part in Django Unchained, I think.
But I know. I grew up with a history buff for a dad, and so I grew up being very well-versed in the Constitution and stuff like that, especially the fact that I'm a network security engineer by trade, and particularly one that was a network security geek.
Do you remember... you're talking about all this stuff and, as it relates to Time Warner.
Yeah.
There was a company that I want to say was very similar to Netflix early on, and they had housings of DVD players. And what they did is they sold a streaming service where literally you would rent a movie and somebody somewhere would put a DVD in a DVD player and hit play. And then I think they existed pretty well and made a whole bunch of capital for like 2 years. And then like the door, they came knocking down their doors.
That one, I can't remember the name of the company, but I know exactly what you're talking about. That case, actually, they got sued out of existence, but eventually they were able to get the case to say, yeah, they had the right to do that, but they lost.
It was done.
But what's interesting, there's another company right now that's operating out of New York City. Let me look it up real quick. The company is, streaming TV.
Well, it's interesting. They usually are born out of sort of non-compliance when it comes to this stuff. Crunchyroll is another good example of a video service that really sort of...
It started illegally, but then the actual anime companies then bought the rights to use it because it had such a fan following.
That's very true. And
the company that's now the big person is called Aereo. They actually have a huge giant facility where all they have are these racks of software antennas that allow you to get a TV digital signal and then be able to watch that through your laptop or through your set-top box or through your iPad, and then it records the
show. For just the New York market?
For just the New York market currently.
Yeah.
But it lets you record shows that are over the FCC-mandated open access broadcasted television networks, and all the television networks are going ape about this because the fact is they don't want their content being downloaded or over the internet. But the fact is it's FCC mandated to have these basic digital channels broadcast.
And plus, first of all, we've been doing that for years. Before the DTV mandate, you pop a tape into your VCR, you hit record. And now, there are encoder, decoder products on the market. They're enterprise level, but you can take a public FCC broadcast stream and bring it down and utilize it. These guys are just scared because they might be losing some money somewhere along the line. So lots of crazy things going on at CES, lots of changes. The public can go sometimes now. There's still very strange things in the South Hall. And really what we're seeing is a slow sort of upslope of adoption as it relates to 4K. But I think it'll probably be a little bit of time before the consumer level folks really embrace it. But it's there in full force for production.
And also the DIY 3D printer stuff.
As always, if you have questions or comments and you would like to talk to the folks over here at the Workflow Show, myself and Nick, you please can send them over to workflowshow@chessa.com.
Patrick, how do people get to you directly? You output a lot of media. You were shooting video out there at CES. You interview a lot of folks. You write a lot of interesting articles. What's your 411?
You can reach me at Plan 8 Media. That's plan8.tv. That's PLAN, the number 8.tv. You can also reach me on Twitter at Roanhouse. That's Roanhouse. Just Google Patrick Roanhouse and you'll find all the work I've done for several publications and Plan 8 Media as well. We're going to be producing new shows soon. So we're going to have about 6 shows coming out the pipe of 15-minute shows that we'll bunch together to make 45-minute shows for people as well. So we'll be producing some really great content soon. And thank you guys for having me on.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you, Merrill. This is Nick, and you've been listening to The Workflow Show. Talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.